Maybe it didn't. He used the same technique with the creature growing inside Elizabeth. "Hello, creature," he transmitted as he pressed his ear into Elizabeth's belly. "It's me, 630. I'm the dog." Whenever he initiated contact, he always reintroduced himself. From his own lessons, he knew repetition was important. The key was not to overdo the repetition, not to make it so tiresome that it actually had an inverse result and caused the student to forget. That was called boredom. According to Elizabeth, boredom was what was wrong with education today. "Creature," he'd communicated last week. 6:30 here. He waited for a response. Sometimes the creature extended a small fist, which he found thrilling. Other times he heard singing. But yesterday, he'd broken the news. "There's something you should know about your father." Annette began to cry. He pressed his nose deep into the grass. "Calvin," he communicated. "We need to talk about Elizabeth." At 2 a.m., about 3 months after Calvin's death, 6:30 found Elizabeth in the kitchen, in her nightgown, wearing galoshes, all the lights blazing. In her hand was a sledgehammer. Much to his surprise, she drew back and swung the sledgehammer directly into a wall of cupboards. She paused as if to assess the carnage, then swung again, bigger this time, like she was trying to hit a home run. Then she kept batting for 2 more hours. 6:30 watched from under the table as she felled the kitchen like a forest, her violent blitz broken only by the surgical attacks on hinges and nails, the old floor filling with piles of hardware and boards as plaster dust sifted over the scene like an unexpected snowfall. Then she picked it all up and hauled it out to the backyard in the dark. "This is where we'll put the shelves," she said to him, pointing at the pot-marked walls. "And over there is where we'll put the centrifuge." She produced a tape measure, and gesturing him out from under the table, inserted one end in his mouth while pointing to the other end of the kitchen. "Take it just down there, 6:30. A little farther, a little farther. Good, hold it right there." She jotted some numbers in a notebook. By 8 a.m., she'd sketched out a rough plan. By 10, a shopping list. By 11, they were in the car and headed to the lumberyard. People often underestimate what a pregnant woman is capable of. But people always underestimate what a grieving pregnant woman is capable of. The man at the lumberyard eyed her curiously. "Your husband doing some remodeling?" he asked, noticing her small bump. "Getting ready for the baby?"
"I'm building a laboratory."
"You mean a nursery?"
"I don't."
He glanced up from her sketch.
"Is there a problem?" she asked.
The materials were delivered later that same day, and armed with a library-obtained set of popular mechanics magazines, she set to work. "Tenpenny nail," she said. 6:30 had no idea what a tenpenny nail was. Nevertheless, he followed the nod of her head to an array of small boxes that lay close by, selected something, then put it in her open palm. 3-inch screw, she'd ask a minute later, and he'd dig into another box. "That's a lag bolt," she said. "Try again." This work would continue all day and often into the night, broken only by their word lessons and the ringing of the doorbell. About 2 weeks after she'd been fired, Dr. Borowitz had dropped by, ostensibly to say hello, but really because he was having trouble interpreting some test results. "It'll only take a quick sec," he promised, but it took 2 hours. The next day the same thing happened, but this time it was another chemist from the lab. The third time, yet another. That's when it came to her. She would charge, cash only. If anyone had the gall to suggest payment was unnecessary because they were simply keeping her in the loop, she would charge double. An offhand remark about Calvin, triple. Any reference to her pregnancy, the glow, the miracle, quadruple. That was how she made a living, by doing other people's work without any credit. It was exactly like working at Hastings, but without the tax liability. "Coming up the walk, I thought I heard banging," one of them said. "I'm building a lab."
"You can't be serious."
"I'm always serious."
"But you're going to be a mother," he said, tutting. "A mother and a scientist," she said, brushing sawdust off her sleeve.
"You're a father, aren't you? A father and a scientist?"
"Yes, but I have a PhD, he emphasized as proof of his superiority. Then he pointed to a set of test protocols that had confounded him for weeks. She looked at him, perplexed. You have two problems, she said, tapping the paper. This temperature is too high. Lower it by 15 degrees. I see. And the other? She cocked her head to the side, taking in his blank expression. Unsolvable. The transformation of kitchen into laboratory took about 4 months, and when it was done, she and 630 stood back to admire their work. The shelves, which spanned the length of the kitchen, were freshly lined with a wide array of laboratory materials, chemicals, flasks, beakers, pipettes, siphon bottles, empty mayonnaise jars, a set of nail files, a stack of litmus paper, a box of medicine droppers, assorted glass rods, the hose from the backyard, and some unused tubing she'd found in the trash bin in the alley behind the local phlebotomy lab. Drawers that once stored utensils were now taken up by acid and puncture-resistant mitts and goggles. She'd also installed metal pans under all the burners to aid in alcohol denaturation, purchased a used centrifuge, cut up a window screen to create a set of 4x4 wire flats, dumped out the last of her favorite perfume to create an alcohol burner, including cutting one of her lipstick containers, which she then stuck into Calvin's old thermos bottle cork, creating the stopper. Made test tube holders out of wire hangers, and converted a spice rack into a suspension structure for various liquids. The friendly formica countertop was gone too, as was the old ceramic sink. In their place, she'd crafted a countertop template using the plywood she'd purchased from the lumberyard, a template that she'd then taken in pieces to a metal fabrication company which had created an exact stainless steel replica, bending and cutting the metal to ensure a perfect fit. Now, atop these gleaming countertops sat one microscope and two used Bunsen burners, one courtesy of Cambridge, the university had given it to Calvin as a memento of his time there, and the other from a high school chem lab that was shedding equipment due to lack of student interest. Just above the new double sinks were two carefully hand-lettered signs. Waste only, read one. H2O source, read the other. Last but not least was the fume hood. This will be your responsibility, she told 630. I'll need you to pull on the chain when my hands are full. You'll also need to learn how to press this big button. Cal, 630 explained to the body below on a later trip to the graveyard. She never sleeps. When she isn't working on the lab or doing other people's work or reading to me, she's erging. And when she isn't erging, she's sitting on a stool staring off into space. This can't be good for the creature. He remembered how Calvin often stared off into space. It's how I focus, he'd explained to 630. But others had complained about the staring too, grousing that on any given day at any given hour, one could find Calvin Evans sitting in a big fancy lab, surrounded by the very best equipment, music blaring, doing absolutely nothing. Worse, he was getting paid to do absolutely nothing. Even worse, he won a lot of awards this way. But her staring is different, 630 tried to communicate. It's more of a death stare, a lethargy. I don't know what to do, he confessed to the bones below. And on top of everything else, she's still trying to teach me words. Which was awful, because he was unable to give her any hope for the future using these words. Besides, even if he knew every word in the English language, he still wouldn't have any idea what to say, because what does one say to someone who's lost everything? She needs hope, Calvin, he thought, pressing hard against the grass in case that made a difference. As if in reply, he heard the click of a safety being released. He looked up to see the cemetery groundskeeper pointing a rifle at him. You damn dog, the groundskeeper said, lining 630 up in his sights. You come in here, you mess up my grass, you think you own the place. 630 froze, his heart pounding. He saw the aftermath. Elizabeth in shock, the creature confused, more blood, more tears, more heartache, another failure on his part. He sprang forward, knocking the man hard to the ground as a bullet sailed past his ear and plowed into Calvin's tombstone. The man cried out and reached for his gun, but 630 bared his teeth and took a step closer. Humans. Some of them didn't seem to grasp their actual status within the animal kingdom. He sized up the old man's neck. One bite to the throat and it would all be over. The man looked up at him, terrified. He'd hit the ground pretty hard. There was a small pool of blood now forming just to the left of his ear. He remembered Calvin's own pool of blood, how large it had been, how it had gone from a simple ooze to a little pond to a big lake in a matter of moments. Reluctantly, he propped himself up against the side of the man's head to staunch the flow. Then he barked until people came. The first on the scene was the same reporter, the one who'd covered Calvin's funeral, the one who was still covering funerals, because his desk editor didn't think he was capable of much more. "You," the reporter said, instantly recognizing 630 as the non-seeing eye dog, the one who'd led the pretty non-blind widow, scratch that, girlfriend, through the sea of crosses to this very gravesite. As others ran up and made hurried plans for an ambulance, the reporter took photographs, composing the story in his head as he posed the dog here, then there. Then he heaved the bloodied animal into his arms, carried him to his car, and drove him to the address listed on his tag. "Relax, relax, he's not injured," the reporter assured Elizabeth as she swung open the door, crying out at the sight of a blood-matted 630 in the arms of a vaguely familiar man. "It's not his blood, but your dog's a hero, lady. At least that's the way I plan to spin it." The next day, a still-shaken Elizabeth opened the newspaper to find 630 on page 11, sitting in exactly the same spot he'd sat 7 months ago on Calvin's grave. "Dog mourns master and saves man's life," she read out loud. "Cemetery dog ban lifted." According to the article, people had long complained about the groundskeeper and his gun, including several who reported he'd shot at squirrels and birds right in the middle of funerals. The man would be replaced immediately, the article promised, as would the grave marker. She peered at the close-up of 630 and Calvin's ruined tombstone, which, thanks to the bullet's impact, had lost about a third of its inscription. "Oh my God," Elizabeth said, taking in the chipped remains. "Calvin E., 1927 to 19. Brilliant Che, your days are new." Her face changed ever so slightly. "Your days are new," she read. "New." She flushed, thinking of the sad night Calvin had shared with her his childhood mantra. "Every day, new." She looked back at the photograph, stunned. Chapter 15. Unsolicited Advice. "Your life is about to change."
"Excuse me?"
"Your life. It's about to change." A woman just ahead of Elizabeth in line at the bank had turned to point at Elizabeth's stomach. Her face was grim. "Change?" Elizabeth said innocently as she cast her eye down upon her round form, as if noticing it for the first time. "Whatever do you mean?" It was the seventh time that week someone felt compelled to inform her that her life was about to change, and she was sick of it. She'd lost her job, her research, bladder control, a clear view of her toes, restful sleep, normal skin, a pain-free back, not to mention all the little assorted freedoms everyone else who is not pregnant takes for granted, like being able to fit behind a steering wheel. The only thing she'd gained? Weight.
"I've been meaning to get this checked," she said, laying a hand on her stomach. "What do you think it could be? Not a tumor, I hope."
For a split second, the woman's eyes widened in shock, then instantly narrowed. "No one likes a smart aleck, missy," she gruffed. "You think you're tired now?" a wiry-haired woman commented an hour later as Elizabeth yawned in a grocery store checkout line, shaking her head as if Elizabeth were already showing signs of personal weakness. "Just you wait." Then she launched into a dramatic description of the terrible twos, the tiresome threes, the filthy fours, and the fearsome fives, barely taking a breath before piling into the angsty adolescence, the pimply pubescence, and especially, oh Lord, the troubled teens, noting always that boys were harder than girls, or girls were harder than boys, and on and on and on, until her groceries were bagged and loaded, and she was forced to get back into her faux wood-paneled station wagon and return home to her own personal set of ingrates. "You're carrying high," the man at the gas station observed. "Definitely a boy."
"You're carrying high," the librarian commented. "Definitely a girl."
"God has given you a gift,"
said a priest who'd noticed Elizabeth standing alone in front of an odd gravestone at the cemetery later that same week. Glory be to God. It wasn't God, Elizabeth said, pointing at a new tombstone. It was Calvin. She waited until he walked away, then bent down and ran her finger over the complex engraving. Calvin Evans, 1927 to 1955, followed by a complex equation. To make up for what happened, cemetery management had told her, we'll not only provide a new tombstone, we'll also make sure it includes the whole quote this time. But Elizabeth had decided against a second round with Marcus Aurelius, opting instead for a chemical response that resulted in happiness. No one else recognized it, but after what she'd been through, no one questioned it either. I'm finally going to see someone about this, Calvin, she said, pointing to her bump. Dr. Mason, the rower, the one who let me row in the men's eight, remember? She stared at the inscription as if awaiting a reply. 25 minutes later, as she pressed a button in a narrow elevator, her only companion a fat man in a straw hat, she braced herself for more unsolicited advice. And sure enough, he reached out his hand and placed it on her belly as if she were a hands-on exhibit at the Natural History Museum. I bet eating for two is fun, he admonished, patting her. But remember, one of them is just a baby. Remove your hand, she said, or live to regret it. Bada bada bada, he sang, thumping her stomach like a bongo drum. Bada bada boom, she rejoined, swinging her handbag directly into his crotch, the impact of which was compounded by a heavy stone mortar she'd picked up earlier that day from chemical supply. The man gasped, then doubled over in pain. The door slid open. Have a bad day, she said. She stomped down the hallway, encountering a 7-foot-tall stork wearing bifocals and a baseball hat. In its beak hung two bundles, one pink, one blue. Elizabeth saw it, she said, moving past the stork to the receptionist. For Dr. Mason? You're late, the receptionist said icily. I'm 5 minutes early, Elizabeth corrected, checking her watch. There's paperwork, the woman informed her, handing over a clipboard. Husband's place of work, husband's telephone number, husband's insurance, husband's age, husband's bank account number. Who's having the baby here? She asked. Room 5, the receptionist said. Down the hallway, second door on the left. Disrobe, put on the gown, finish the paperwork. Room 5, Elizabeth repeated, clipboard in hand. Just one question. Why the stork? Excuse me? Your stork. Why, in an obstetrician's office? It's almost as if you're promoting the competition. It's meant to be charming, the receptionist said. Room 5. And since every patient of yours is 100% aware that a stork isn't going to spare them the pain of labor, she continued, why perpetuate the myth at all? Dr. Mason, the receptionist said as a man in a white coat approached, this is your 4 o'clock. She's late. I tried to send her to room 5. Not late, Elizabeth Zott corrected. On time. She turned to the doctor. Dr. Mason, you probably don't remember me. Calvin Evans' wife, he said, drawing back in surprise. Or, no, I apologize, he said, dropping his voice. His widow. Then he paused as if trying to decide what to say next. I'm so very sorry for your loss, Mrs. Evans, he said, covering her hands with his and giving them a few shakes, as if mixing a small cocktail. Your husband was a good man and a good rower. It's Elizabeth Zott, Elizabeth said. Calvin and I weren't married. She paused, awaiting the receptionist's tusk and Mason's dismissal. But instead, the doctor clicked a pen and tapped it into his breast pocket, then took her by the elbow and led her down the hallway. You and Evans rode in my aid a few times, do you remember? About 7 months ago. Good rows, too. But then you never came back. Why was that? She looked at him, surprised. Oh, forgive me, Dr. Mason said in a rush. I'm so sorry. Of course. Evans. Evans died. I apologize. Shaking his head in embarrassment, he pushed open the door to room 5. Please, come in. He pointed to a chair. Are you still rowing? No. What am I saying? Of course not. Not in your condition. He took her hands and turned them over. But this is unusual. You still have the calluses. I'm erging. Good God. Is that bad? Calvin built an erg. Why? He just did. It's all right, isn't it?
Well, yes, he said. Certainly. It's just that I've never heard of anyone erging on purpose, especially not a pregnant woman. Although, now that I think about it, erging is a good preparation for childbirth, in terms of suffering, I mean. Actually, both pain and suffering. But then he realized pain and suffering had probably been a constant in her life since Evans died, and he turned away to hide his latest gaffe.
"Shall we take a quick look under the hood?" he said gently, gesturing to the table. Then he closed the door and waited behind a screen while she put on a dressing gown. The examination was quick but thorough, punctuated with inquiries about heartburn and bloating. Was sleep difficult? Did the baby move at certain times? If so, for how long? And finally, the big question, why had she waited so long to come in? She was well into her last trimester.
Work, she told him.
But that was a lie. The real reason was because she quietly hoped the pregnancy would take care of itself. End as these things sometimes do. In the 1950s, abortion was out of the question. Coincidentally, so was having a baby out of wedlock.
You're also a scientist, is that right? He asked from the other end of her body.
Yes.
And Hastings kept you on? They must be more progressive than I thought.
They didn't, she said. I'm freelancing.
A freelance scientist? I've never heard of such a thing. How does that work?
She sighed. Not very well. Registering the tone in her voice, he finished up quickly, tapping her belly here and there as if she were a cantaloupe.
Everything looks ship-shape, he said as he stripped off his gloves. And when she didn't smile or say anything in return, he said in a low voice, "For the baby, at least. I'm sure this has been enormously difficult for you." It was the first time someone had acknowledged her situation, and the shock of it caught in her throat. She felt a cache of tears threatening escape just behind her eyes.
I'm sorry, he said, gently, studying her face the way a meteorologist might watch a storm develop.
Please know you can talk to me, rower to rower. It's all confidential.
She looked away. She didn't really know him. Worse, she wasn't sure, despite his assurances, that her feelings were allowable. She'd come to believe she was the only woman on Earth who planned to remain childless. If I'm being perfectly honest, she finally said, her voice heavy with guilt, I don't think I can do this. I was not planning on being a mother.
Not every woman wants to be a mother, he agreed, surprising her. More to the point, not every woman should be.
He grimaced as if thinking of someone in particular. Still, I'm surprised by how many women sign up for motherhood, considering how difficult pregnancy can be. Morning sickness, stretch marks, death.
Again, you're fine, he added quickly, taking in her horrified face. It's just that we tend to treat pregnancy as the most common condition in the world, as ordinary as stubbing a toe, when the truth is, it's like getting hit by a truck. Although, obviously, a truck causes less damage. He cleared his throat, then made a note in her file. What I mean to say is, the exercise is helping, although I'm not sure how you erg properly at this stage. Pulling into the sternum would be problematic. What about the Jack LaLanne show? Have you ever watched him?
At the mention of Jack LaLanne's name, Elizabeth's face fell.
Not a fan? He said. No problem. Just the erg, then.
I only kept on with it, she offered in a low voice, because it exhausts me to the point where I can sometimes sleep, but also because I thought it might, well.
I understand, he said, cutting her off and looking both ways as if making sure no one else could hear. Look, I'm not one of those people who believe a woman should have to. He stopped abruptly. Nor do I believe that. He stopped again. A single woman, a widow, it's. Never mind, he said as he reached for her file. But the truth is, that erg probably made you stronger, made the baby stronger for that matter. More blood to the brain, better circulation. Have you noticed it has a calming effect on the baby? Probably all that back and forth. She shrugged.
How far are you erging?
10,000 meters.
Every day?
Sometimes more.
Mother of God, he whistled. I've always thought pregnant women developed an extra capacity for suffering, but 10,000 meters, sometimes more? That's actually, I don't know what that is.
He looked at her with concern. Do you have someone to lean on? A friend or relative? Your mother, someone like that. Infants are hard work.
She hesitated. It was embarrassing to admit that she had no one. She'd only gone to see Dr. Mason because Calvin had always insisted Rovers enjoyed some sort of special bond.
Anyone? He repeated. I have a dog.
I like it, Mason said. A dog can be tremendously helpful, protective, empathetic, intelligent. What kind of dog?
He? She?
He. Wait, I think I remember your dog. 3 o'clock, something like that. Ugly as sin? He's a dog and an erg, he said, making a note in her file.
Okay, excellent.
He clicked his pen again, then set her file aside. Now, as soon as you're able, let's say in a year, I want to see you back at the boathouse. My boat's been looking for the right 2-seat, and something tells me you're it. You'll have to arrange for a sitter, though. No babies in the boat. We have plenty of those, as it is.
Elizabeth reached for her jacket.
That's very kind, Dr. Mason, she said, assuming he was only trying to be nice. But according to you, I'm about to get hit by a truck.
An accident from which you will recover, he corrected.
Look, I have an impeccable memory when it comes to Rose, and I very much remember ours. They were good. Very good.
Because of Calvin.
Dr. Mason looked surprised. No, Miss Zott. Not just because of Evans. It takes all 8 to row well. All 8. Anyway, back to the business at hand. I'm starting to feel a bit better about your situation. I know you've been through quite a shock with Evans passing, and then this, he added, pointing to her belly. But things will be fine. Maybe even better than fine. A dog, an erg, 2-seat.
Excellent.
Then he took both of her hands in his and gave them a cheerful squeeze. And although his words hadn't made complete sense, compared to everything else she'd heard up to that point, they were the first that finally made some. Chapter 16. Labor. Library? Elizabeth asked 6:30 about 5 weeks later. I've got an appointment with Dr. Mason later today, and I'd like to return these books first. I'm thinking you might enjoy Moby Dick. It's a story about how humans continually underestimate other life forms, at their peril. In addition to the receptive learning technique, Elizabeth had been reading aloud to him, long ago replacing simple children's books with far weightier texts. Reading aloud promotes brain development, she'd told him, quoting a research study she'd read. It also speeds vocabulary accumulation. It seemed to be working because, according to her notebook, he now knew 391 words. You're a very smart dog, she'd told him just yesterday, and he longed to agree. But the truth was, he still didn't understand what smart meant. The word seemed to have as many definitions as there were species, and yet humans, with the exception of Elizabeth, seemed to only recognize smart if and when it played by their own rules. Dolphins are smart, they'd say. But cows aren't. This seemed partly based on the fact that cows didn't do tricks. In 630's view, that made cows smarter, not dumber. But again, what did he know? 391 words, according to Elizabeth. But really, only 390. Worse, he just learned that English wasn't the only human language. Elizabeth revealed that there were hundreds, maybe thousands of others, and that no human spoke them all. In fact, most people spoke only 1, maybe 2, unless they were something called Swiss and spoke 8. No wonder people didn't understand animals. They could barely understand each other. At least she realized he would not be able to draw. Drawing seemed to be the way young children preferred to communicate, and he admired their efforts, even if the results fell short of the mark. Not a day went by when he didn't witness little fingers earnestly pressing their chunky chalks into the sidewalk, their impossible houses and primitive stick figures filling the cement with a story no one understood but themselves.
What a pretty picture, he heard her mother say earlier that week as she looked down on her child's ugly, violent scribble. Human parents, he'd noted, had a tendency to lie to their children.
It's a puppy, her child said, her hands covered in chalk.
And such a pretty puppy, the mother rejoined.
No. The child said, it's not pretty. The puppy's dead. It got killed.
Which 6:30, after a second, closer look, found disturbingly accurate.
It is not a dead puppy, the mother said sternly. It's a very happy puppy, and it's eating a bowl of ice cream.
at which point the frustrated child flung the chalk across the grass and stomped off for the swings. He retrieved it, a gift for the creature. They walked the 5 blocks together, Elizabeth in a shirt dress that strained at her bump, striding as if going off to war. On her back was a bright red satchel stuffed with books. On his, bike messenger panniers repurposed for all the extra books her satchel could not hold. "I'm starving," she said aloud as they walked, the air heavy with November. "I could eat a horse. I've been monitoring my urine, analyzing my hair proteins," and this was true. She'd been tracking her urine's glucose levels, noting the amino acid chain of her hair's keratin, and analyzing her body's temperature in the lab for the last 2 months. It wasn't clear to 6:30 what any of it meant, but he was relieved to see her taking more interest in their creature, more scientific interest, at least. Her only practical preparation had been the purchase of thick white cloth squares and several dangerous-looking pins. She'd also purchased 3 tiny outfits that looked like sacks. "It sounds fairly straightforward," she told him as they strode down the street. "I'll experience pre-labor, then labor. We've still got 2 weeks to go, 6:30, but I think it's good to think about these things now. The important thing to remember," she said, "is that when the time comes, we stay calm." But 6:30 was not calm. Her water had broken several hours earlier. She hadn't noticed because she'd expelled only a modest amount of moisture, but he noticed because he was a dog. The scent was unmistakable. As for her hunger pains, they weren't hunger pains. They were pre-labor contractions. As they neared the library's front door, the creature decided to make things a bit clearer. "Oh," Elizabeth moaned, doubling over. "Oh my God." 13 hours later, Dr. Mason held the infant up for an exhausted Elizabeth to see. "That's a big one," he said, looking at the baby as if he just reeled in a catch. "Definitely a rower. Don't quote me, but I think she'll row port." He looked down at Elizabeth. "Good job, Miss Sott. And you did it all without anesthesia. I told you all that erging would come in handy. She's got great lungs." He peered at the baby's tiny hands as if imagining future calluses. "You'll both be with us for a few days. I'll swing by your room tomorrow. In the meantime, rest." But worried about 6:30, Elizabeth checked herself out the very next morning. "Absolutely not," the head nurse said, "completely against protocol. Dr. Mason will have a fit." "Tell him I need to erg," she said. "He'll approve." "Erg?" the nurse practically shouted as Elizabeth dialed for a cab. "What is erg?" 30 minutes later, Elizabeth walked up the driveway, the baby tucked snugly against her chest, her heart pounding with relief at the sight of 6:30, panniers still on, sitting like a sentry at the front door. "Oh my God," 6:30 panted. Oh my God, you're alive. You're alive. Oh my God, I was so worried." She bent down and showed him the bundle. The creature was, sniff, a girl. "It's a girl," Elizabeth told him, smiling. "Hello, creature. It's me, 6:30. I've been worried sick." "I'm so sorry," she said, unlocking the door. "You must be starving. It's," she consulted her watch, 9:22. You haven't eaten in more than 24 hours. 6:30 wagged his tail in excitement. Just as some families give their children names starting with the same letter, Agatha, Alfred, and others prefer the rhyme, Molly, Polly, his family went by the clock. He was named 6:30 to commemorate the exact time they'd become a family, and now he knew what the creature would be called. "Hello, 9:22, he communicated. "Welcome to life on the outside. How is the trip? Please come in. Come in. I've got chalk." As the three of them bustled through the door, a strange joy filled the air. For the first time since Calvin's death, it felt as if they'd turned a corner. Until 10 minutes later, when the creature started to cry and everything fell apart. Chapter 17. Harriet Sloane. "What's wrong?" Elizabeth begged for the millionth time. "Just tell me." But the baby, who'd been crying nonstop for weeks, refused to be specific. Even 6:30 was flummoxed. "But I told you about your father," he communicated. We talked about this, but still the creature wailed. Elizabeth paced the small bungalow at 2 a.m., bouncing the bundle up and down, her arms stiff like a rusted robot, until she ran into a stack of books and almost tripped. "Damn it," she cried, mashing the baby against her chest in a protective move. In her new mother stupor, the floor had become a convenient dumping ground for everything. Tiny socks, unsecured diaper pins, old banana peels, unread newspapers. "How can someone this small cause all this?" she cried. In response, the baby placed its tiny mouth against Elizabeth's ear, took a deep breath, and roared back the answer. "Please," Elizabeth whispered, sinking into a chair. "Please, please, please, stop." She nestled her daughter in the crook of her arm, nudged the bottle's nipple against her doll lips, and although she'd refused it 5 times before, the little thing latched on voraciously, as if she knew her ignorant mother would get there in the end. Elizabeth held her breath, as if the smallest intake of air might cause the thing to go off again. The baby was a ticking time bomb. One false move, and it was over. Dr. Mason had warned her that infants were hard work, but this wasn't work. It was indenture. The tiny tyrant was no less demanding than Nero, no less insane than King Ludwig. And the crying, it made her feel inadequate. Worse, it raised the possibility that her daughter might not like her. Already. Elizabeth closed her eyes and saw her own mother, a cigarette stuck to her bottom lip, her ashes landing in the casserole Elizabeth had just taken out of the oven. Yes. Not liking one's mother from the very start was entirely possible. Beyond that, there was the repetitiveness, the feeding, the bathing, the changing, the calming, the wiping, the burping, the soothing, the pacing, in short, the volume. Many things were repetitive, erging, metronomes, fireworks, but all of those things usually ended within an hour. This could go on for years. And when the baby slept, which was never, there was still more work to be done. Laundry, bottle prep, sanitizing, meals, plus the constant rereading of Dr. Spock's The Common Sense Book of Baby and Child Care. There was so much to do, she couldn't even make a to-do list because making a list was just one more thing to do. Plus, she still had all of her other work to do. Hastings. She glanced in worry across the room at an untouched foot-high pile of notebooks and research papers. The larger stacks work from her colleagues. When she'd been in labor, she told Dr. Mason, she didn't want anesthesia. "It's because I'm a scientist," she'd lied. "I want to be fully conscious during the procedure." But the real reason? She couldn't afford it. From below came a small sigh of contentment, and Elizabeth looked down surprised to find her daughter asleep. She froze, not wanting to disturb the baby's slumber. She studied the flushed face, the pouty lips, the slim blonde eyebrows. An hour went by, and with it, all circulation in her arm. She stared in wonder as the child moved her lips as if trying to explain. 2 more hours went by. "Get up," she told herself. "Move." She leaned forward, gently propelling both of them out of the chair, then walked without a single misstep to the bedroom. She lay down, carefully placed the still sleeping infant beside her. She closed her eyes, she exhaled, then she slept heavily, dreamlessly, until the baby awoke, which, according to her clock, was approximately 5 minutes later. "This a good time?" Dr. Borowitz asked at 7 a.m. as she opened the door. He tipped his head and moved past her, picking his way through the war zone to the sofa. "No. Well, but this isn't really work," he explained. "Just a quick question. Anyway, I wanted to drop by and see how it's going. I heard you had the baby." He took in her unwashed hair, her misbuttoned blouse, her still swollen abdomen. He unlatched his briefcase and took out a wrapped gift. "Congratulations," he said. You got me a gift? "Just a small thing." "Do you have children, Dr. Borowitz?" His eyes slid left. He didn't reply. She opened the box to find a plastic pacifier and a small stuffed rabbit. "Thank you," she said, suddenly feeling glad he'd dropped by. He was the first adult she'd talked to in weeks. "Very thoughtful." "You're very welcome," he said clumsily. "I hope she enjoys it." "She," She, as in Banshee, 630 explained. Borowitz reached into his briefcase to pull out a sheaf of papers.
I haven't slept, Dr. Borowitz, Elizabeth apologized. This really isn't a good time.
Miss Zott, Borowitz pleaded, his eyes downcast. I've got a meeting with Donati in 2 hours. He removed some bills from his wallet. Please.
The sight of the cash made her hesitate. She hadn't had any income for a month.
10 minutes, she said, taking the cash. The baby's only dozing, but he needed a full hour.
After he left, and surprised to find the baby still sleeping, she made her way to her lab, determined to work, but without meaning to, she slid to the floor as if it were a mattress, her head craning toward a textbook as if it were a pillow. In moments, she was sound asleep. Calvin was in her dream. He was reading a book on nuclear magnetic resonance. She was reading Madame Bovary aloud to 630. She'd just finished telling 630 that fiction was problematic. People were always insisting they knew what it meant, even if the writer hadn't meant that at all, and even if what they thought it meant had no actual meaning. Bovary's a great example, she said. Here, where Emma licks her fingers, some believe it signifies carnal lust. Others think she really just liked the chicken. As for what Flaubert actually meant, no one cares. At this point, Calvin looked up from his book and said, I don't remember there being any chicken in Madame Bovary. But before Elizabeth could reply, there came an insistent tap, 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 like an industrious woodpecker, followed by a Miss Zott, followed by more tap, 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 tapping. Then another Miss Zott, followed by a strange little hiccupy wail, which made Calvin jump up and run out of the room. Miss Zott, the voice said again. It was louder. Elizabeth awoke to find a large, gray-haired woman in a rayon dress and thick brown socks looming in her laboratory.
It's me, Miss Zott. Mrs. Sloane? I peeked in and saw you slumped on the floor. I knocked and knocked, but you didn't respond, so I pushed open the door. I wanted to make sure you're all right. Are you all right? Maybe I should call a doctor?
Sloane?
The woman bent down and studied Elizabeth's face.
No, I think you're all right. Your baby is crying. Shall I go get it?
I'll go get it.
She left, returning a moment later.
Oh, look at it, she said, rocking the small bundle back and forth. What's the devil's name?
Mad. Madeline, Elizabeth said as she pushed off from the floor.
Madeline, Miss Sloane said. A girl. Well, that's nice. I've been wanting to drop by ever since you brought your little Satan home. I've told myself, go by and check on her. But you seem to have a constant stream of visitors. In fact, I saw one leave not long ago. I didn't want to intrude.
The woman held Madeline's bottom up to her nose, took a deep sniff, then laid her on the table, and, swiping a clean diaper from the nearby drying rack, chained the writhing infant like a cowboy roping a calf.
I know it can't be easy for you, Miss Zott, without Mr. Evans, I mean. I'm very sorry for your loss. By the way, I know it's a bit late to say so, but better late than never. Mr. Evans was a good man.
You knew Calvin? Elizabeth asked, still foggy.
How?
Miss Zott, she said pointedly, I'm your neighbor, across the street, in the little blue house?
Oh, yes, of course, Elizabeth said, reddening, realizing she'd never spoken to Mrs. Sloane before. A few waves from the driveway, that'd have been it.
I'm sorry, Mrs. Sloane, of course I know you. Please forgive me, I'm tired. I must have fallen asleep on the floor. I can't believe I did that. It's a first.
Well, it won't be the last, Mrs. Sloane said,
suddenly noticing that the kitchen was not really a kitchen at all. She got up and, holding Madeline in the crook of one arm like a football, gave herself a tour.
You're a new mother, and you're all alone, and you're exhausted, and you can barely think, and what the hell is this?
She pointed at a large silver object.
A centrifuge, Elizabeth said. And no, I'm fine, really.
She attempted to sit up straight.
No one's fine with a newborn, Miss Zott. The little gremlin will suck the life right out of you. Look at you. You've got the death row look. Let me make you some coffee.
She started toward the stove, but was stopped by the fume hood. For the love of God, she said, what the hell happened to this kitchen?
I'll make it, Elizabeth said, as Mrs. Sloane watched. Elizabeth drifted to the stainless steel counter where she picked up a jug of distilled water and poured it into a flask, plugging the flask with a stopper outfitted with a tube wriggling from its top. Next, she clipped the flask onto one of two metal stands that stood between two Bunsen burners and struck a strange metal gadget that sparked like flint striking steel. A flame appeared. The water began to heat. Reaching up to a shelf, she grabbed a sack labeled C8H10N4O2, dumped some into a mortar, ground it with a pestle, overturned the resulting dirt-like substance onto a strange little scale, then dumped the scale's contents into a 6x6-inch piece of cheesecloth and tied the small bundle off. Stuffing the cheesecloth into a larger beaker, she attached it to the second metal stand, clamping the tube coming out of the first flask into the large beaker's bottom. As the water in the flask started to bubble, Mrs. Sloane, her jaw practically on the floor, watched as the water forced its way up the tube and into the beaker. Soon, the smaller flask was almost empty, and Elizabeth shut off the Bunsen burner. She stirred the contents of the beaker with a glass rod. Then, the brown liquid did the strangest thing. It rose up like a poltergeist and returned to the original flask. "Cream and sugar?" Elizabeth asked as she removed the stopper from the flask and started to pour. "Mother of God," Mrs. Sloane said as Elizabeth placed a cup of coffee in front of her. "Have you never heard of Folgers?" But as soon as she took a sip, she said no more. She'd never had coffee like this before. It was heaven. She could drink it all day. "So how have you found it so far?" Mrs. Sloane asked. "Motherhood." Elizabeth swallowed hard. "I see you've got the Bible," Mrs. Sloane said, noting Dr. Spock's book on the table. "I bought it for the title," Elizabeth admitted. "Common Sense Book of Baby and Child Care. There seems to be so much nonsense about how one raises a baby, so much overcomplication." Mrs. Sloane studied Elizabeth's face. A strange remark coming from a woman who just added 20 extra steps to making a cup of coffee. "Funny, isn't it?" Mrs. Sloane said. "A man writes a book about things of which he has absolutely no first-hand knowledge, childbirth and its aftermath, I mean, and yet, boom, bestseller. My suspicion? His wife wrote the whole thing, then put his name on it. A man's name gives it more authority, don't you think?"
"No," Elizabeth said.
"Agreed." They both took another sip of coffee. "Hello there, 6:30, she said, extending her free hand. He went to her.
"You know 6:30?
Miss Zott, I live just there, across the street. I often see him out and about. By the way, there's a leash law in effect."
At the word leash, Madeline opened her tiny mouth and let loose a blood-curdling cry.
"Oh, Jesus Mary, Mother of God," Mrs. Sloane swore as she leapt up, Madeline still in her arms. "That is truly hideous, child."
She looked into the small red face and bounced the bundle around the laboratory, her voice raised above the noise.
"Years ago, when I was a new mother, Mr. Sloane was away on business, and a horrible man broke into the house and said if I didn't give him all our money, he'd take the baby. I hadn't slept or showered in 4 days, hadn't combed my hair for at least a week, hadn't sat down in I don't know how long. So I said, 'You want the baby? Here.'"
She shifted Madeline to the other arm.
"Never seen a grown man run so fast."
She glanced around the room uncertainly.
"Do you have some fancy way of fixing a bottle, too? Or can I make it like normal?"
"I've got one ready," Elizabeth said, retrieving a bottle from a small pan of warm water.
"Newborns are horrible," Mrs. Sloane said, clutching at the fake pearls around her neck as Elizabeth took Madeline from her. "I thought you had some help, otherwise I would have come earlier. You've had so many, well, so many men dropping by at the oddest hours." She cleared her throat.
"It's work," Elizabeth said as she coaxed Madeline to take the bottle.
"Whatever you want to call it," Mrs. Sloane said.
"I'm a scientist," Elizabeth said.
"I thought Mr. Evans was the scientist."
"I'm one too."
"Of course you are," she clapped her hands together. "All right then, I'll get going. But now you know, whenever you need a spare pair of hands, I'm across the street." She wrote her phone number in thick pencil directly on the kitchen wall just above the phone.
Mr. Sloan retired last year, and he's at home all the time now, so don't think you'll be interrupting anything, because you won't. In fact, you'll be doing me a favor. Understood?
She bent down to retrieve something from her shopping bag.
I'll just leave this here, she said, removing a foil-wrapped casserole. I'm not saying it's good, but you need to eat.
Mrs. Sloan, Elizabeth said, realizing she did not want to be alone. You seem to know a lot about babies.
As much as anyone can ever know, she agreed. They're selfish little sadists. The question is why anyone has more than one.
How many did you have?
4. What are you trying to say, Miss Zott? Are you worried about something in particular?
Well, Elizabeth said, trying to keep her voice from wavering, it's just that...
Just say it, Sloan instructed. Boom, out.
I'm a terrible mother, she said in a rush. It's not just the way you found me asleep on the job, it's many things, or rather, everything.
Be more specific.
Well, for instance, Dr. Spock says I'm supposed to put her on a schedule, so I made one, but she won't follow it. Harriet Sloan snorted. And I'm not having any of those moments you're supposed to have. You know, the moments?
I don't.
The blissful moments?
Women's magazine rot, Sloan interrupted. You need to steer clear of that stuff. It's complete fiction.
But the feelings I'm having, I don't think they're normal. I never wanted to have children, she said. And now I have one. I'm ashamed to say I've been ready to give her away at least twice now.
Mrs. Thone stopped at the back door.
Please, Elizabeth begged, don't think badly of me.
Wait, Sloane said, as if she'd misheard. You've wanted to give her away twice? Then she shook her head and laughed in a way that made Elizabeth shrink.
It's not funny.
Twice? Really? 20 times would still make you an amateur.
Elizabeth looked away.
Hell's bells, huffed Mrs. Sloan sympathetically. You're in the midst of the toughest job in the world. Did your mother never tell you?
At the mention of her mother, Sloan noticed the young woman's shoulders tense.
Okay, she said in a softer tone. Never mind. Just try not to worry so much. You're doing fine, Miss Zott. It'll get better.
What if it doesn't? Elizabeth said desperately. What if it gets worse?
Although she wasn't the type to touch people, Mrs. Sloan found herself leaving the sanctuary of the door to press down lightly on the young woman's shoulders.
It gets better, she said.
What's your name, Miss Zott?
Elizabeth.
Mrs. Sloan lifted her hands.
Well, Elizabeth, I'm Harriet.
And then there was an awkward silence, as if by sharing their names, they'd each revealed more than they'd planned.
Before I go, Elizabeth, can I offer just one bit of advice?
Harriet began.
Actually, no, I won't. I hate getting advice, especially unsolicited advice. She turned a ruddy color. Do you hate advice givers?
I do. They have a way of making one feel inadequate, and the advice is usually lousy.
Go on, Elizabeth urged.
Harriet hesitated, then pursed her lips side to side.
Well, fine. Maybe it's not really advice anyway. It's more like a tip.
Elizabeth looked back expectantly.
Take a moment for yourself, Harriet said, every day.
A moment?
A moment where you are your own priority. Just you. Not your baby. Not your work. Not your dead Mr. Evans. Not your filthy house. Not anything. Just you, Elizabeth Zott. Whatever you need, whatever you want, whatever you seek, reconnect with it in that moment.
She gave a sharp tug to her fake pearls.
Then recommit.
And although Harriet didn't mention she'd never followed this advice herself, that she'd actually only read it in one of those ridiculous women's magazines, she wanted to believe that someday she would recommit to her goal, to be in love, real love. Then she opened the back door and gave a small nod and pulled the door closed behind her, and as if on cue, Madeline began to cry.
Chapter 18. Legally Mad.
Harriet Sloan had never been pretty, but she'd known pretty people, and they always seemed to attract trouble. They were either loved for being pretty or hated for exactly the same reason. When Calvin Evans began dating Elizabeth Zott, Harriet assumed pretty was why. But when she first spied on them from her perch in the living room, their curtains obligingly parted to give her an unobstructed view into their living room, she had to rethink her assumption. To her, it seemed Calvin and Elizabeth had enjoyed a strange relationship, almost supernatural, like identical twins separated at birth who accidentally stumble upon each other in a foxhole and, despite death all around, are amazed to discover that not only do they look alike and share a serious allergy to clams, but neither liked Dean Martin. Really? She imagined Calvin and Elizabeth saying to each other all the time. Me too. It hadn't been that way with her and the now-retired Mr. Sloan. The only excitement had come at the beginning, but it had worn off like cheap nail polish. She found him bold because he had a tattoo and seemed not to notice that her ankles were thick and her hair was thin. In retrospect, that should have been a clue, that he didn't notice her. Because then maybe she would have realized he was never going to notice her. She couldn't remember how soon into their marriage she began to realize she wasn't in love with him, nor he with her. But it was probably somewhere between the way he pronounced drawer, jar, and the way his thicket of body hair constantly detached itself like seeds from a dandelion head, blanketing their home. Yes, living with Mr. Sloan was revolting, but Harriet was not completely repelled by his physical defects. She shed herself. Rather, it was his low-grade stupidity she abhorred, his dull, opinionated, know-nothing, charmless complexion. His ignorance, bigotry, vulgarity, insensitivity, and above all, his wholly undeserved faith in himself. Like most stupid people, Mr. Sloan wasn't smart enough to know just how stupid he was. When Elizabeth Zott moved in with Calvin Evans, Mr. Sloan took instant notice. He talked about her constantly, his comments lewd and low like a mangy hyena.
Would you look at that, he'd say, staring out the window at the young woman getting in her car while rubbing his naked belly in a circular motion, dispersing tiny black curls to every corner of the room. Yeah.
Whenever this happened, Harriet left the room. She knew she should be used to it by now, his desire for other women. It was on their honeymoon that he'd first masturbated to girly magazines right next to her in bed. She'd gone along with it because what else was she supposed to do? Besides, she'd been told it was normal, healthy even. But as the magazines got raunchier, the habit grew. And now here she was, 55 years old, neatening his sticky stack of periodicals with a stone in her heart. That was the other revolting thing about him. Like so many undesirable men, Mr. Sloan truly believed other women found him attractive. Harriet had no idea where that specific brand of self-confidence came from, because while stupid people may not know they're stupid because they're stupid, surely unattractive people must know they're unattractive because of mirrors. Not that there was anything wrong with being unattractive. She was unattractive and she knew it. She also knew that Calvin Evans was unattractive, and the sloppy dog Elizabeth brought home one day was unattractive. And there was a good chance Elizabeth's future baby would be unattractive, too. But none of them were, or would ever be, ugly. Only Mr. Sloan was ugly, and that was because he was unattractive on the inside. In reality, the only physically beautiful thing on the entire block was Elizabeth herself. And Harriet had avoided her for that very reason. Like she'd said, pretty people were trouble. But then Mr. Evans had died, and those ridiculous men with their self-important briefcases kept stopping by Elizabeth's house, and she realized that she might have picked up some of Mr. Sloan's judgmental ways. That's why she'd gone that day to check on Elizabeth, because while she was stuck forever being Mrs. Sloan, she was a Catholic. She never wanted to turn into a Mr. Sloan. And besides, she knew what newborns were like.
Call me. She begged, peeking through her curtains at the house across the street. Call me, call me, call me.
On the other side of the street, Elizabeth had picked up the phone to dial Harriet Sloan at least a dozen times in the last 4 days, but each time she'd failed to complete the call. She'd always thought herself a capable human being, but suddenly, based solely on the small amount of time she'd spent in Harriet's presence, she realized she was not. She stood at the window and looked across the street. A sort of desperation gripped her. She'd had a baby and would be raising it to adulthood. My God, adulthood. From across the room, Madeline announced it was feeding time.
But you just ate, Elizabeth reminded her.
Well, I don't remember,
Madeline screamed back, formally initiating the least fun game in the world. Guess what I want now? She had another problem. Every time Elizabeth looked into her daughter's eyes, Calvin looked back. It was unnerving. The truth was, she was still mad at Calvin, the way he'd lied to her about her research funding, the way his sperm defied the contraceptive odds, the way he'd run outdoors when everyone else ran indoors in ballet slippers. She knew being mad at him was unfair, but grief is like that, arbitrary. Anyway, no one else knew how mad she was. She'd kept it to herself. Well, except during labor, when she might have shouted some regrettable things, her fingernails possibly digging into some unknown person's forearm as the bigger contractions took hold. She remembered someone besides herself shrieking and swearing. It seemed strange and unprofessional. So, sometime after it was all over, when a nurse came in with a stack of papers demanding to know something, how she felt, she decided to tell her. Mad. Mad? The nurse had asked. Yes, mad, Elizabeth had answered, because she was. Are you sure? The nurse had asked. Of course I'm sure. And the nurse, who was tired of tending to women who were never at their best, this one had practically engraved her name on her arm during labor, wrote mad on the birth certificate and stalked out. So there it was. The baby's legal name was Mad. Mad Zot. Elizabeth only discovered the issue a few days later at home when she'd stumbled across the birth certificate in a jumble of hospital paperwork still lumped on the kitchen table. What's this? She'd said, looking at the fancy calligraph certificate in astonishment. Mad Zot? For God's sake! Did I take off that much skin? She immediately set about to rename the baby. But there was a problem. She'd originally believed the right name would present itself the moment she saw her daughter's face, but it hadn't. Now, standing in her laboratory, looking down at the small lump who lay sleeping in a large basket lined with blankets, she studied her child's features. Suzanne? She said cautiously. Suzanne Zot? But it didn't feel right. Lisa? Lisa Zot? Zelda Zot? Nothing. Helen Zot? She tried. Fiona Zot? Marie Zot? Still nothing. She placed her hands on her hips, as if bracing herself. Mad Zot, she finally ventured. The baby's eyes flew open. From his station beneath the table, 630 exhaled. He'd spent enough time on a playground to understand one could not name a child just anything, especially when the baby's name had only come about from misunderstanding or, in Elizabeth's case, payback. In his opinion, names mattered more than the gender, more than tradition, more than whatever sounded nice. A name defined a person, or, in his case, a dog. It was a personal flag one waved the rest of one's life. It had to be right. Like his name, which he'd had to wait more than a year to receive, 630. Did it get any better than that? Mad Zot. He heard Elizabeth whisper, "Dear God." 6:30 got up and padded off to the bedroom. Unbeknownst to Elizabeth, he'd been stashing biscuits under the bed for months, a practice he'd started just after Calvin died. It wasn't because he feared Elizabeth might forget to feed him, but rather because he'd made his own important chemical discovery. When faced with a serious problem, he found it helped to eat. Mad. He considered chewing a biscuit. Madge, Mary, Monica. He withdrew another biscuit, crunching loudly. He was very fond of his biscuits, yet another triumph from the kitchens of Elizabeth Zot. It made him think, why not name the baby after something in the kitchen? Pot. Pot Zot. Or from the lab. Beaker. Beaker Zot. Or maybe something that actually meant chemistry. Something like, well, chem. But Kim, like Kim Novak, his favorite actress from The Man with the Golden Arm. Kim Zot? No, Kim was too short. And then he thought, what about Madeline? Elizabeth had read him Remembrance of Things Past. He couldn't really recommend it, but he had understood that one part. The part about the Madeline. The biscuit. Madeline Zot. Why not? What do you think of the name Madeline? Elizabeth asked him, after finding Proust inexplicably propped open on her nightstand. He looked back at her, his face blank. The only problem was getting Mad's name changed to Madeline required a trip to City Hall, and once there, a form that demanded a marriage certificate and several other details Elizabeth wasn't very excited to share. You know what? Elizabeth said, meeting 6:30 on the stairs just outside the building. We'll just keep this between ourselves. She's legally Mad, but we'll call her Madeline and no one will be the wiser. Legally Mad, 6:30 thought. What could possibly go wrong? The other thing about Mad, she got really mad when the Hastings people dropped by. Colicky, Dr. Spock would have diagnosed, but Elizabeth thought it might be that the baby was a good judge of character, which worried her. Because what, then, would she think of her own mother's character? A woman who didn't speak to her family, who refused to marry a man she deeply loved, who'd gotten fired from her job, who'd spent her days teaching her dog words. Would she seem selfish or crazy or both? She wasn't sure, but she had a feeling that the woman across the street would know. Elizabeth wasn't one for church, but there was something holy about Harriet Sloane. She was like a practical priest, someone to whom one could confess things, fears, hopes, mistakes, and expect in return not a simpleton's recipe for prayers and beads or a psychologist's standard. And how does that make you feel? Run around, but actual wisdom. How to get on with the business at hand. How to survive. She picked up the phone, unaware that Harriet's binoculars were already confirming the dialing pattern from her front window. Hello? Harriet answered casually as she forced her binoculars back between the sofa cushions. You've reached the Sloane residence? Harriet, this is Elizabeth Zot. Be right over. Chapter 19, December 1956. The biggest benefit in being the child of a scientist, low safety bar. As soon as Mad could walk, Elizabeth encouraged her to touch, taste, toss, bounce, burn, rip, spill, shake, mix, splatter, sniff, and lick nearly everything she encountered. Mad! Harriet shouted every morning as she let herself in. Put that down! Down, Mad agreed, flinging a half-filled coffee cup across the room. No! Shouted Harriet. No, agreed Mad. As Harriet fetched the mop, Madeline teetered into the living room, picking up this, discarding that, her grubby little hands automatically reaching for the too sharp, too hot, too toxic, the things most parents keep out of reach on purpose, in short, the best things. Nevertheless, she lived. It was because of 6:30. He was always there, sniffing out danger, blocking light sockets, positioning himself beneath the bookshelf so when she scaled it, which she did nearly every day, he would be the cushion that broke her fall. He'd failed once to protect someone he loved. He would not fail again. Elizabeth, Harriet scolded her, you can't just let Mad do whatever she wants. You're absolutely right, Harriet, Elizabeth said without taking her eyes off three test tubes. You'll notice I've moved the knives. Elizabeth, Harriet implored. You have to watch her. I found her crawling into the washing machine yesterday. Don't worry, Elizabeth said, still staring at the test tubes. I never start a load without checking first. Yet despite her constant state of alarm, Harriet could not dispute that Mad seemed to be growing in ways her children never had. Even more unusual, the mother-daughter relationship had a symmetry Harriet could not ignore. The child learned from the mother, but the mother also learned from the child. And it was like a mutual adoration society. You could see it in the way Mad looked at Elizabeth when she was being read to, the way she crowed when her mother whispered in her ear, the way Elizabeth beamed when the child combined baking soda with vinegar, the way they constantly shared whatever they were thinking and doing, chemistry, babble, drool, sometimes using a sort of secret language that felt to Harriet just a bit exclusionary. One could not, should not, be one's child's friend, she warned Elizabeth. She'd read that in one of her magazines. She watched as Elizabeth popped Mad up onto her lap, then held her close to the bubbling test tubes. The child's eyes filled with wonder. What had Elizabeth called her teaching method? Experiential learning? Children are sponges, Elizabeth explained the previous week as Harriet chided her for reading aloud to Madeline from On the Origin of Species. I'm not about to allow Mad to dry out early.
Dry, Mad shouted. Dry, dry, dry.
But surely she can't understand a word of what Darwin wrote, Harriet argued. At the very least, couldn't you read her the abridged version? Harriet only ever read abridged versions. Reader's Digest was her favorite publication for that very reason. They cut big, boring books down to a chewable size like St. Joseph Aspirin. She once overheard a woman in the park saying she wished Reader's Digest would condense the Bible, and Harriet found herself thinking, yes, and marriages. I don't believe in abridgments, Elizabeth said. Anyway, I think Mad and 6:30 enjoy it. That was the other thing. Elizabeth read to 6:30, too. Harriet was fond of 6:30. In fact, sometimes she felt like she and the dog shared